Keep Talking exists to have conversations that might help to make a better society and a better culture. I believe that each guest has important information and stories to make public. This is the Keep Talking podcast. To support it, please take a second and subscribe to the show. It helps to make this content possible. I'd love to get the story from your perspective as to when you thought you were hitting on the fact that there was something amiss with boys and men in our society. How do you make sense of that story? When did you begin to think that there was something worth writing about here?
Well, to be honest, I've been interested in gender issues and, you know, male-female relationships pretty much since the beginning of my career. But I would say that earlier in my career, it was through a more traditionally feminist lens. And I've wondered about, and I have written back in the UK where I'm from, as you can probably tell by now. I did write a little bit about how if we didn't equalize the work between men and women on the home front, we weren't going to get to equality in the work front. And so I have been interested in these issues. But then as I was doing work at Brookings on class and race and inequality, which has been really the sort of main thrust of my work over the last few years, I'm interested in family trends and education trends. I just kept stumbling across facts about boys and men that were more startling. They were just sharp. I knew some of the basic trends, but I didn't know how bad things were, especially for some boys and men. And then I'm raising three boys as well. I've raised three boys to adulthood and on both sides of the pond. And so the dinner table conversations were quite often about how to be a man in this new world, you know, what's going on in schools. And so in the end, the line between those conversations started blurring. And I felt an absence of a conversation grounded in facts, mostly away from partisanship, just about what's really going on with boys and men and why. And that's conducted in good faith. And so it felt to me as if that was potentially a contribution I could make. And I came to believe that this is a necessary part of the debate. If we want to make progress, we can't do that if we continue, which I think we really have, to ignore these issues or neglect them, or rather that only, I would say, in many cases, some quite irresponsible parties will exploit it. So I felt in some ways that I ought to write it. And then, of course, there's always risk with this kind of book. I don't want to overstate the bravery thing. You know, there's this whole thing, you're so brave. I'm like, well, I mean, my great-grandfather was wounded in the Battle of the Somme, and my grandfather fought in France. And so I sometimes conjure them up from the grave and tell them about the bad day I had when some nasty tweets were sent my way or some horror emails. And I try to imagine how sympathetic they would be to me. So I don't want to overstate that at all. But I did have a bunch of people saying, look, no, you don't want to go here. This is too dangerous. And I was, really? You're kidding me. In that case, I really have to do it, right? Because if I can't do it with the position I'm in, then we're in real trouble. And so in some ways, people were saying, well, be careful, spurred me to do it, and not out of some sense of vainglory or an attempt to outdo my, you know, predecessor's bravery, but just because I thought, well, in that case, if that's true, then we have a problem.
Yeah. I think for people who have not yet read your book, it is just packed with data and charts and is grounded, as you just mentioned, in fact, which is the basis for, you know, any rational conversation about reality and what is happening in the world and in our society. I'd love to just, you know, send this question to you, which is, what is the state of men and boys right now? You know, I understand the comments. I'm not surprised that you're getting some feedback about the bravery and taking on a subject matter that is controversial, to say the least. And I think for myself, just in getting more familiar with the data that's in the book, I think a lot of people who are alive today, especially older people, my parents' generation, would not expect the data to be revealing what it is revealing. And maybe it makes sense to start with education specifically. What's going on there? To me, it seems like the facts and the data and the performance and the achievement between the sexes has inverted in about 40 years, that the place men used to hold about 40 or 50 years ago has now been flipped. What do we know about what's going on with boys right now in education specifically?
Yeah, I think that's basically right. That's the basic story. And again, it's one of the reasons why I thought it was worth drawing more attention to some of these trends, because It's no one's job to draw attention to these trends. And so whilst there are lots of institutions who do a very good job of drawing attention to the problems of women and girls, and it's literally their job, and I commend them for their work, there aren't really institutions whose job it is to highlight gender inequalities when they go the other way. And so I think that it's interesting how surprised, I was surprised by some of these facts too. So let's put a couple of data points on the table. In 1972, when Title IX was passed, which was the legislation to promote women and girls in higher education, men were about 13 percentage points more likely to get a four-year college degree than women. And now women are 15 percentage points more likely to get a four-year college degree than men. Women caught up through the 70s and the 80s, overtook within a couple of decades, and just kept going. And so now we have more gender inequality in higher education than we did in 1972 when Title IX was passed. It's just the other way around. And so there's been this great overtaking, essentially, of women past men and of girls past boys. In high school, there's actually been a long-standing edge for girls in terms of high school GPA, but the gap has really opened up in recent decades. And so now if you rank high schoolers by their GPA, and you look at the top 10% by GPA, two-thirds of them are girls, and the bottom 10%, two-thirds of them are boys, with a pretty linear relationship in between the two. And we could go on, but the basic story is that on pretty much every measure, at pretty much every level, and in pretty much every advanced economy, women didn't just catch up with men or girls with boys, they blew right past them. Mm. And it's worth saying no one expected that. When we were fighting for women and girls in the 70s and 80s in education, nobody said, wait, what if the lines just keep going? Mm. What do we do then? And so there's actually just been no real conversation about this new world because nobody predicted it. We were focused on parity. No one expected the lines to keep going and for this new gender gap to emerge in the other direction. So we're not psychologically equipped for it. We're not institutionally equipped for it. So, and I think we're really trying to catch up. We're trying to catch up with the facts on the ground.
Yeah. I know one of the elements to this that you talk about in the book, which is relation to trying to answer the question as to why this has happened. And I think it's your belief that, you know, women in school and academic performance on average tend to possess qualities that make their success in that forum much more likely than men, that when you equalize the playing field, women by nature of their conscientiousness and other personality factors tend to be more organized, be more capable of performing in that kind of a setting. What is going on there? How do you explain how this has happened to women accelerating and men simultaneously falling behind? What is the best answer we have as to why that's happened?
Yeah, well, first of all, I appreciate your emphasis that these are differences on average, Dan. maybe we can give ourselves permission to just presume that that is in every answer we give. Distributions overlap and on average, because I find sometimes when I'm talking about the book, I'm so aware that someone might take one bit of it and say, he didn't say on average, but they end up saying on average, on average, on average. And it's really boring for the listeners. can we just edit that in later, right?
I think we should start with that. Yes.
Right. Just everything's on average because of course it is an important point that they are on average. But yeah, I think in some ways, one of the most provocative claims I make is that the education system is female friendly. It favors girls and women in structural ways. And that is a shocking claim because the education system was designed by and largely led by and dominated by men for pretty much forever. And so that's a shocking claim. So I'll defend it in the following way, which is that the sorts of skills that girls develop more than boys and earlier than boys are the ones you referred to, conscientiousness, attention to detail, ability to sit still, focus on task, future orientation. The prefrontal cortex bit of the brain develops earlier in girls and they just have a natural advantage anyway. So they're better and earlier. So I describe the prefrontal cortex in the brain as the bit that tells you to do your chemistry homework and the bit that remembers you have chemistry homework and the bit that cares about your high school GPA, because at some sense, your future self might benefit from a higher high school GPA. And those are just more developed in girls and young women, and they develop earlier in girls and young women. So just from a neuroscientific perspective, they have that advantage. Now, the immediate response to that, well, if that's true, why have we only seen these gaps opening up in recent years? Because that's not new. And I think the answer to that is sexism. The truth is that when women's educational opportunities and aspirations were capped by a sexist society, we couldn't see the natural advantages. The fact that girls were better than boys didn't show up when they weren't going to college, but now they are. So eventually we took the brakes off. We had these artificial brakes on girls and women. We took them off and they flew by. And to use your analogy, you know, we leveled the playing field, and in doing so, discovered that the girls and women were better players. And now they're smoking the boys for that reason. So it's not deliberate, but it's just an irony that it took the women's movement to reveal the fact that the education system slightly favors girls and women. The other two things I'd briefly touch on are the fact that the education system is becoming more female dominated on the teaching front. Only 24% of K-12 teachers now are men. That's down from 33% in the 80s. So we are seeing more, and only 1 in 10 elementary school teachers are male. And there is some evidence that having male teachers helps boys, especially in subjects like English. And thirdly, there's been an increased focus on what you might think of as book learning, more academic, narrow kinds of learning, and less emphasis on vocational styles of learning, more hands-on learning. And that typically, that latter type of learning tends to favor boys a bit more. They're a bit better at learning by doing than learning by sitting. And so those trends together have ended up creating a system that I think is quite clearly more favorable to girls and women.
Yeah, I know another stat that you have cited before is that I believe it's something like 2% of kindergarten teachers, 2% are male. And you speak about, I think it's Air Force pilots, that it's 3 times the number of women are Air Force pilots or pilots in the military flying jets and so forth than there are kindergarten teachers teaching young children. And I know just in having conversations with other people that I was going to speak with you and bringing up this subject, and just in my own life in the last few years, you know, anytime I would bring up ideas that you explore in your book, because I had picked up on this in the past few years from some other articles and books that men were not doing particularly well, there was a palpable sense in conversation oftentimes with even close family friends and people who are extremely close to me, who are women, who are older, and you, to me, I could sense a reaction to them of fuck them. You know, who cares? It's about time that women take hold of the reins of power and men shut up and not, you know, be a rising, you know, be in rising consistent places of power, that it's about time that something like this happened. How do you respond to people like that who learn about these statistics and aren't alarmed by it? They're thrilled. They're thrilled by the fact that there has been such a growth of female accomplishment and opportunities. What's your response to that?
Well, the first thing I say is that I get it. I mean, I think that visceral reaction is well founded, given the work that women have had to do to get to this point. And it's essentially happens in a blink of an eye. And so there is this sense of like, okay, so wait, so women have just gotten ahead on certain measures, you know, not on every measure, which we might get to, and you're already turning around and doing the kind of, you know, oh my God, boys and men are in crisis, like tiny violins time. And so I get that. And interesting, there is a bit of a generational gap here too. I think I've noticed that it is among slightly older women where you get that strongest reaction. And I think that's because they were the ones that had to fight so hard.
Yeah.
They just went through the trenches in a way that younger women haven't had to. I mean, younger women have really benefited from the incredible work that older generation of feminists were engaged in. So I do think that, you know, that's, and I think given what they had to fight for, you know, I have a colleague who's considerably older than me who, you know, was literally didn't go to college, was told to become a secretary and ended up with a PhD and working in the White House and, you know, one of the most senior people at Brookings, who's in her 80s now. And she talks about what it was like for her as a woman in economics. she can't get over how the world has changed. And but that's such a rapid change. That's the first thing I would say. But the second thing is, like, we want everyone to flourish. That was the point of the liberation movement. And once you've gotten past that initial sense of, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Like, really? If you just, like, yeah, most people, when it comes down to it, do worry about the people who are suffering. And if it's specifically, we might get into this, working class men, especially black boys and men, the boys from the back with the least are really struggling. And that's just a fact. And so are you really going to say, well, we're not going to care about men's problems for what? I don't know, 1,000 years or something, right? Then we'll call it quits. No one really thinks like that. That's the equivalent of a parent saying they care less about their son or their daughter. They don't. And most ordinary people actually are perfectly open to this conversation, which is, hey, there's a whole bunch of things that we still need to do for girls and women, but I'm really worried about these things about boys and men. And I think it's actually borderline cruel to just say, yeah, men are 3 or 4 times more likely to kill themselves. But, you know, patriarchy. I don't think that's how many people actually think. So once you get past that initial reaction, as long as you're grounded by it, and as long as you honor that reaction, I think that's key. Because I think a lot of people are like, no, here's the facts. It's outrageous. You know, here's the, I've seen the, you know, you're wrong. And no, that reaction of like, the are you kidding me reaction is a perfectly understandable and honorable reaction to this conversation. And we don't push it away. So I understand it. I embrace it. I feel it. But then let's move on.
Yeah. Yeah. Just sort of dovetailing onto that. I remember reading in a book once that when Sandra Day O'Connor graduated from Stanford Law School, and I think it was 1953, which is the same year my mom was born, her only professional opportunity she was presented with when she, upon graduating, was to be a secretary. You know, that wasn't that long ago. And I'd love, and I'm grateful that you brought this up, because I would love to dig into the suffering, the stories and the knowledge that we have about the experience of young men and boys and young men in our society. And you just talked about the suicide rate, and you go into the deaths of despair in the country, which I think in general are labeled as overdoses and suicides. And 3 out of every 4 people who fit into that category, I believe, are men. What do we know about the suffering of modern day men? Who are these people, and what tends to be their story?
So the men who are suffering the most are the ones who've been most affected by recent social and economic trends. The impact of free trade and automation on male industries in particular has been really significant. And so you'll see in a lot of communities where there's basically been a hollowing out of male jobs in particular, and difficulty on the part of men in adapting to that new world. And so there is that sense of a loss of status that went with that traditional status within the labor market. And then that can cause all kinds of problems with family formation and just general detachment and anomie, to use the kind of sociologist phrase. But deaths of despair gets really close to it. I think it's interesting. It's, and also alcohol-related illnesses. Now, men account for about 70% of opioid deaths as well. As you say, 3 times higher risk of these general areas of deaths of despair, between 3 and 4 times higher rate of suicide, especially, and it's growing really fast among middle-aged men in particular. And it does seem to be the men who've been most affected by economic and social changes in recent decades who are most at risk of it. And opioids is a really interesting example, I think, because there are drugs that you take to go out partying, right? You might take MDMA or something because it's great to go for a rave, or you want to think you're funnier, so you take cocaine or whatever. Those are sort of drugs. There are before and night out drugs, but opioids are drugs of retreat. And one of the reasons why we have such high death rates from opioids is because there's no one there. The user dies alone, indoors, alone. And so to the extent that opioids are, they're about painkillers, but they're not just about this. Maybe start as physical painkillers, but become almost existential painkillers. And so it's very troubling to me that so many men are opting for one kind of painkiller or another, with obviously potentially fatal consequences. And so that's the group I'm most worried about. In that regard, the deaths of despair, and I think that to look at that and not see a specific gendered lens through which we have to examine the causes is just not to see the data. It's hard to imagine any other field where you'd see a more than three to one difference in the risk ratio and not say, okay, we might need a more gender sensitive response.
Yeah. And I know you have spoken about this related to men who really are seemingly opting out. It isn't that they're flaming out. They're not getting angry. And often, even though I know we have, every month or two, a story about a mass shooter in the country who often fits kind of a lonely, isolated man. In general, I think from what I've understood from your interviews, it's more men who are opting out of the system altogether, that they are alone. They are, opting for these sort of isolating drugs. They're addicted to porn. They just don't seemingly have the motivation to go out into the world and continue to struggle anymore. They're, playing a lot of video games. How do you make sense of how men are getting there? You talked about automation and that's had a huge effect on men's inability to, compete economically in many circumstances. But in general, the men who end up opting out of society, and I think you make this distinction in the book, that for men who are graduating from the top schools, who have the top jobs, this doesn't necessarily seem to be an issue, that it seems to be trickling down the socioeconomic ladder, that it's more likely that men in those categories will be afflicted by some of these issues. How do they get there? What's the best sense you make of that?
Yes, I think that's the correct framing. I think it's worth saying that even among upper middle class men who are doing better educationally and economically and so on, it's not to suggest that we don't have any problems. We're having to renegotiate identity. Mm. We're going to have to live in a world very different to the one our fathers were in, and respond to the changed dating market and marriage market for sure. But that's just much easier if you're affluent and well-educated. I think equality is much easier for the affluent. Mm. The men who are struggling most with the transition are the ones who have less economic power. And you do see this detachment. And I think you're right to characterize my position as being much more worried about the men who are checking out than the men who are acting out. Mm. The men who act out get the headlines. But for every one man who does something terrible and newsworthy, there are millions that we should be worried about who are going the other way. And I'm really, I get very concerned when an analysis is offered. I think one just landed in my inbox a few moments ago, I think, where, a mass shooter is, classic crisis of masculinity, loneliness, et cetera. This is what happens, right? And I've had people, quite thoughtful people, say to me, yeah, we really do need to worry about boys and men. Otherwise, they'll all become mass shooters. Mm-hmm. I mean, that kind of thought. And I find that to be really unhelpful because it's, first of all, I think it's quite offensive to a lot of these men, which is to say there's an incipient mass shooter in all of them. It tars them with the broader brush, but it also just misses the fact that violent crime has massively dropped in recent decades, including a sexual assault, everything. I mean, we've become so much more peaceful. And because most violence is from men, and that is an area where there's a difference on average, but the distributions don't overlap very much. There's a massive difference on average, right? Largely because of testosterone. So society has become so much more peaceful, much less male violence. I mean, the typical man today is so much less violent than the typical man was even 40 years ago. It's an extraordinary drop. So that's the backdrop, right? Much, 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 much less male violence. And then, of course, you get these exceptions. But in this case, the exceptions are proving the rule. And so I'm worried much more about the things you referred to, which is detachment, dislocation, retreat, rather than acting out. Mm. And to the extent that actually, there are alternatives online now, including things like video games and pornography, those are always seen as a bad thing. And we can talk about that if you like. I think they're largely in themselves not a bad thing. They might displace other activities in the real world. But there's a more provocative thought, which is maybe it's good news that there are those alternatives. Because what else would these men be doing if they were left, lost, they've lost status, they've lost identity. At least now they do have those alternatives. And so I can't really ground this thought empirically, but there's a possibility that we're being saved by the screens to some extent. But the danger then is that if it's an easier path to take, men might take it and then avoid some of the harder work to be done, which we have to do to adapt to the modern world, both romantically, economically, culturally, and educationally. And so I worry that it's more of an opt out than an act out.
Yeah, I think it's such an interesting counterfactual thought experiment of what the culture would look like without those two items, right? That people are, I think, in some ways, understandably concerned about the effect of long-term porn use and access to free porn along with video games on men. But if both of those things weren't available, what would single, detached, testosterone-driven young men by the millions be doing? I think there's good reason to think that the violent crime data that you were just speaking about would not be as rosy as it looks.
Yeah, well, that was the concern of the social conservatives in the 70s, some of whom I engage with in the book, like George Gilder and Jeffrey Dench and others, which was, look, if men end up without a clear role, if the women's movement gets its way and women become economically independent, they won't need men anymore. So the men will be left to their own devices. Men left to their own devices are a dangerous group. What we're going to have is these marauding bands of like Mad Max style men, incredibly violent, not attached, etc. And that hasn't happened, even though the first thing did happen. So women have secured a huge degree of economic independence. There are a lot of men now who to some extent are culturally redundant, if not economically redundant. And we haven't seen this spike in violence. In fact, we've seen exactly the opposite. And so, yeah, I agree. Obviously we don't know, but I think it's perfectly plausible to say that things could be a lot worse absent those alternative forms of spending your time.
We talked about the data related to education specifically, and I'd love to spend a little bit more time based on a data-driven, fact-driven component to our conversation related to what else we know about the state of men and boys today. Again, we've already talked about some of the data related to, you know, university degrees, and you go into some fascinating stuff in the book related to, you know, degrees related to dentists. And at one point, a couple years ago, I think it was in 2020, every editor-in-chief of every Ivy League school was a woman. I think the majority of MDs also are now being awarded to women. What's some of the other data that convinces you that, you know, men in general in our society are in peril that I think is worth the public knowing about?
Well, I think the sort of small stats, let's distinguish maybe between, let's try this out, big stats and small stats.
Yeah.
So you get these big stats, which are like college enrollment, right? We already talked about the fact, I mean, college campus is now 60% female, women ahead in every, they talk about millions of people. In the labor market, which we could talk a bit more about, but in the labor market, most men today earn less than most men did in 1979. Whereas the median woman is 35 percentage points better off, and there's been a rise across the board. And so those are big data points. But then you get these small data points, like the one you just mentioned about Ivy League colleges. And in fact, the same was true of all law review journals at the top 16 law schools. Every single one of them, I think it was in 2021, was edited by a woman. And then another small stat, and again, it's one of the sort of breadcrumbs along the way that leads you to think, I need to write about this. There's something deeper going on here. Was the massive difference in studying abroad and volunteering. And so studying abroad in every subject, 2-1 women to men. AmeriCorps, the domestic volunteering program, 2-1 women to men. The Peace Corps overseas, 2-1 women to men. In the UK, voluntary service overseas, the equivalent of the Peace Corps, 70% women. And so you're seeing all these stats, which are like this relatively small numbers of people there you're talking about. So this is not like does it matter? I don't know, but it's just fascinating when you start to see that, because it's like, and no one had any good answers to it. Like, why are women so much more likely to pack their bags and go and study abroad? What's going on there? And it leads me to think that there are issues here around agency and motivation, kind of get up and go-ness. And that we've had this incredibly empowering message around women, which is, I think, being the new script around femininity is incredibly empowering. And it's been very successful, and it's really great. I mean, it's the You Go Girl. It's just a fantastic, I love it. But what's the message to men? The presumption has been, well, they don't need a message. They'll be fine. But that's not true. And absent the previous set of incentives they had around traditional roles, they're in a world where they don't. So my sons are growing up in a world, they don't have the same incentive structure around them that my father had. Mm. But they've also been in a world where the women are just smoking them educationally. And all the language is about feminine, female empowerment. What do they do? What's the message to them? And absent a strong message, maybe we shouldn't be surprised that they're just, you know, a little bit more drifty than the women.
Yeah. And, you know, to me, you are the perfect person to be writing this book. Not only are you a scholar in this area of research, but you also have raised three boys yourself. And, you know, I would love to get your thoughts and maybe just focus some time on if there are young men or men in general who watch this or are listening to this, who identify with a lot of what you just mentioned. They feel detached. They feel adrift. They don't see kind of the natural incentives that may have been there for men a generation ago to, you know, self-actualize and to get out of bed in the morning and to struggle and to push themselves. How do you think about, you know, advice or, and I want to get into, mm-hmm. you know, the Jordan Petersons and the Andrew Tates, which mm-hmm. I know you've written about, but mm-hmm. maybe if we could focus specifically on what you think the right pieces of advice or the right pieces of motivation that you think are worth men contemplating that might actually spark an intrinsic desire to go and begin to, you know, as Jordan Peterson says, you know, clean your room and make your bed and go out and work. How do you think about that? How would you respond?
Yeah, so I think what's positive about that aspect of Peterson's message is that focus on agency. I like that. I think it's important to say the world doesn't owe you anything anymore, right? So you're going to have to be agentic. What I don't like is that it underemphasizes the structural barriers that men are facing. He individualizes the problem in a way that actually everyone's individualizing the problem of men right now. It's just that the conservatives like him say, stand up straight with your shoulders back, become more of a man in some ways. And did you notice I just couldn't stop myself from sitting up straight when I said that? It's like, okay. It's like Jordan's here.
He's here somewhere. He's in all of us.
sit up straight. And I got to tell you, I wish my sons all read the Peterson book. I wish they'd paid more attention to the one about clean your room. but it's still a sense of like, it's on you. And on the left, of course, there's this sense of, well, yeah, you just need to get all that toxic masculinity, you know, out of you. And then you'll be fine, right? If you drop the misogyny, you'll be okay. Become more like a woman. So one of my lines is that the left says, be more like your sister. And the right says, be more like your father. And men are like, wait, that doesn't work. I don't want to be my sister, but I can't be like my father. And so they both locate the problem at the individual level. All of that said, I do think that the message, and this is like, here I'm speaking from personal experience as well as just from the scholarship, is the world where you didn't have to show agency and purpose has gone. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to do this under your own steam. Mm-hmm. And I think that sense of being under your own power and having direction and purpose is just much, much more important now. And I think that's a message that's been really strongly given to women. And you see that. And I think you feel men being a bit underpowered now. And I think that's because of this sense of like, where am I supposed to go? Where's the power to come from? But do it, and I'll give you a personal example in a moment, but do it under your own steam, because it turns out that if you want, let's say, assume you're straight, it's probably true for gay men too, your potential future partner probably wants someone who's got their shit together, has a purpose in life, is going somewhere, right? Has an idea about where to go to dinner tonight. Mm. They're not going to say it's up to you. Mm. Has goals for themselves. And it's just second order what the goals are. It's just like a sense of like, okay, I'm under my own steam. And also, you're going to be a father one day, presumably. And although it's difficult for young men sometimes because that can feel like a distant prospect, your kids are going to need you, and they're going to need you to be providing for them, but not only in the old way, but in the new way as well. And hopefully you're going to model for them what it means to be a mature man in the modern world. So again, get your shit together. And so that's where I think the Petersonian stuff is quite powerful, because it does send a message of agency to men. And it says, okay, pick yourself up. I'll give you an example. Like one of my kids was at college. She dropped out of college. Stopped out of college because he's gone back now, because he fulfilled a lifelong dream to become an esports coach. Coaching Rainbow Six Siege, professional Rainbow Six Siege team. He'd wanted this throughout his adolescence. One of the reasons he, you know, torched high school was because all of his passion and intelligence and energy went into coaching Rainbow Six Siege, which I got to tell you, particularly his mother, to some extent me, didn't think was the best route. We actually thought, why didn't you graduate high school and go to college and boring things like that rather than spend all your time coaching a video game? But he carried on. And then he called one day and he said, hey, Dad, I've been offered a chance to go and coach a professional team. What's the deal? He said, well, they'll fly me to Las Vegas, give me an apartment and pay me $50,000 or $60,000 a year plus bonus. Do you think I should do it? I said, yes. Hell yeah. And it's like, you'll always regret it if you don't, right? That'll be the path not taken. And it tended, you know, as it turned out, he didn't do it for all that long, but in the process, he had to fire people and learned a lot about politics and had a blast and did all this stuff. But the most important thing was, I said to him, this is entirely your doing. The idea that you becoming a professional esports coach was anything to do with your parents is obviously laughable. And I'm incredibly proud of you because this is you. This is your dream. This is you propelling yourself. And it doesn't matter what else it is. It's like, and so make it about you. Like, you just go for it. And again, that's a message that I think the women's movement has really given to women. And men are still stuck between this old world where it's like your role was going to fall in your lap and this new world where you got to go get it yourself. And that's the gap I think a lot of men are falling into and why they're so open to someone coming along and just telling them what to do. Right. Yeah. I have to tell you that son never made his bed, never tidied his room, but he's definitely under his own propulsion.
Yeah. There's something, one of my favorite interviews, I've said this before on the show, that I've done was with one of my favorite Jungian writers named Jim Hollis, who I think will end up being maybe a second version of a Jordan Peterson in 5 or 10 years, because so much of what he talks about is exactly what you just said, of basically taking the Jungian idea of individuating, of taking your own inner weirdness and talents and following your own path forward. And, you know, that I think in his mind is part of what the modern hero's journey really is taking the uniqueness that each person possesses. And he mostly is a counselor for men. And that he told me this on the show, that when he first started being a counselor, he's now in his early 80s, he had, you know, 9 out of every 10 people who came to see him, and he's fully booked and is a relatively famous guy now. When he started, it was nine women for every one guy, and now it's inverted. And a lot of his books, I think, are they remind me of a, in many ways, sort of wiser, softer books akin to like a Peterson type. And I go back and consult his stuff constantly because I think he's just so great. But I want to get back to Peterson as a phenomenon, because I know you know, you have recently written an article about him, and that, you know, to me, in following the arc of his career, he seemed to become almost like a digital father for millions of young men. And when I first moved to Austin 4 years ago, I went to see him when he was on his book tour for the 12 Rules for Life book in one of the biggest venues in Austin. It was sold out with thousands of people who were there. And I know he replicated that all over the country and the world. And, you know, you just talked about some of the components to him and his work that, you know, that you have, or your perspective on him. I'd love to get your thoughts on, you know, anything else that you make of that man and that phenomenon. And I do want to pivot to Andrew Tate, who I know you also talked about. But you know, in general, my macro view of how you're writing about this is that in the vacuum of a kind of cultural archetype or a North Star, generally speaking, for men have a natural thirst for role models and people to emulate and stories that are driving their life. And I think this is fair to say, based upon your book, that in so much of the focus that has been given, in many ways, rightly so, to women prospering over the last many decades, that no longer really exists, along with the crumbling of male opportunities in, you know, technical trades and kind of, you know, union work that has been decimated, certainly from my hometown where I come from, in kind of the Rust Belt. And in the wake of, you know, kind of a lot of men losing a sense of what it means to be a man today, there is obviously a hunger for strong, competent, accomplished men to give direction for men. It's a long statement there, but I'd love to just put that to you and get your general thoughts on anything else you might think about the Peterson phenomenon in general. And then I want to shift to the Tate phenomenon too.
Okay. Well, one of the problems with talking to someone who's engaged with the work so much, Dan, is that you've done a pretty good job of laying it out. But I maybe could add a couple of things. I essentially agree with what you've just said, and it's a correct characterization of my position as well. I see Peterson as a gigantic listening ear. I mean, he's a psychologist by training, so it's appropriate. And he just stumbled across this huge reservoir of human need. I mean, he didn't set out to find it. He did all kinds of stuff to draw attention. But he's like someone that's just digging in their backyard and like hits an oil well.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you're gonna drill it. So I don't blame him for that. But I do think it was kind of semi-accidental. But he's genuinely compassionate. He listens. And the fact that just basically by listening and suggesting you make your own bed and take responsibility for your life means you sell 5 million books and have a global sellout tour is a data point that anybody serious about understanding society cannot ignore. And that anybody who just dismisses all this as it's just misogyny is really missing something very important, which is he is filling this need. I like your description of his digital father figure. I think that's right. And because he's willing to lay out a script, he's willing to say, like, this is how to be, within certain considerable limits, I would say, that just makes him an incredibly attractive figure. So I think the broader point, and I've been thinking more about this even since I finished the book, is just like, what's the script for mature masculinity? And I think of this now as like, we had a script which was like the old one, breadwinner, husband, and we tore that up because of the rise of women's economic independence. There used to be a script for women, you know, you're going to be a wife and mother. We tore that up, but we replaced it with this incredibly empowering new script, which we've talked about, right? So there's this new script now for being a woman, which is really incredibly positive, but we didn't replace the male one. Mm-hmm. And so the result is basically a lot of men have been thrust onto the stage and had the script torn out of their hands or torn up in front of them, literally as they enter the stage. And so they're doing the only thing you can do, which is improvise and making it up as they go. And then from walking on from the wings, a Jordan Peterson figure saying, I got you. This is what to do. This is how to be. And so that's an incredibly important moment. And so I think to the extent that masculinity has to be scripted, and I think it does, if anything, even more than femininity does, as a social and cultural construct, then if we're not doing it, we as in broader society and mainstream institutions, then of course other people are going to do it. So to that extent, the scriptlessness of men's lives now creates this massive demand, and then Peterson meets it. Then, of course, enter Andrew Tate, this Romanian British internet personality, who is, the way I think about him now, and I can't remember if I wrote this in the piece or not for Unheard, but he is basically making people nostalgic for Peterson in the same way that people got nostalgic for George W. Bush as soon as Trump got elected, right? I can't tell you the number of liberal friends they had who started saying, oh, Bush, he was pretty good, actually. Yeah, he's no, isn't what you said. You thought he was the devil incarnate. So everything's relative, it turns out. And, you know, by comparison to the horrifying misogyny of many of Tate's comments, you know, Peterson does seem like this tweedy, harmless Canadian professor. But again, the fact of his popularity is I think it's confused, the reason for his popularity. So, you know, I don't know. I'd love to know what your view of Tate is, because I'll tell you that my son told me months ago, 6 months before I finished the book, you have to write about Andrew Tate. I said, who's Andrew Tate? I saw some clips. I ignored him. Of course, my son was right. And now everyone's like, you don't mention Andrew Tate in your book. So yeah. He was right. He saw it early because he's in the right demographic. He's 20 years old. And so everybody he knows about Andrew Tate. But he's just like a new and darker version of I would even say a darker version of Peterson. That's not fair to Jordan Peterson, actually. But he really is. He's tapping into a similar well, but I think in a much more invidious way.
Yeah. I know you mentioned this in that article, that his TikTok videos, Andrew Tate's TikTok videos, have been viewed 12 billion times.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about him enough, honestly, to make an informed, particularly thoughtful comment on the phenomenon that is him. But just in the little that I have spoken to him, that I know about him, you know, he's 20 years younger, 30 years younger than Peterson. So he's a younger version of a masculine figure, and he does exude that hyper alphaness that I think a lot of men who are not doing particularly well or are not particularly satisfied with their lives, it is a very seductive persona to potentially adopt in an attempt to succeed professionally, attract more women, get respect that you don't feel like you are having right now. That hard ass edge, I think, can be appealing to a lot of, you know, nice guys who spend most of their days on a computer and don't have a lot of, you know, excitement or interest in people that they may want to get their attention of. And I don't know. And do you have any other, I don't know how much you have watched his stuff, if you have any other views on
a fair amount now. I mean, there's still quite a lot on there. The one thing I would recommend if people are interested in him, and of course, there's always the danger of drawing more attention to him, but he did a Piers Morgan sat down with him. And I think that's a very good way to get a sense of him. But I agree. And also I've talked to a lot of like young men and young women about him more recently. And you're right. He's aspirational in that sense. They're also, a lot of them are also able to kind of keep quite an ironic distance from him as well. I think it's important, like, not that those 12 billion views are not people just all lapping it up and saying, yeah, you're right. Some of it was, yeah, 'cause it can be quite funny. It's so outlandish and so transgressive that it's mesmerizing. And I do think actually it does show you that just transgressing against these is very attractive as well. I think the mere act of transgressing against these, what some people would see as these kind of narrow views about gender, that people like that. They like him. They like the fact that he says what he thinks, if indeed it is what he thinks, despite how outrageous it is, because that seems to be him, quotes, being his own man. And I think that being your own man phrase, I'm using the term deliberately there, is actually something that is quite appealing to people. I think Donald Trump had some of that as well. And actually that's not just attractive to many men, but to some women, because what they're seeing is someone is like, here I am and here I stand. And this is what I believe, and I don't care what anyone else thinks. And I was actually watching an Andrew Tate video with a young woman and a couple of young men, and she said, he seems very confident. And that's yes, he does, to a degree that's troubling in many cases. There's some rumor he's just converted to Islam, by the way. I think that's just breaking news now, but so that sense of just absolute security, and it cuts so much against this, particularly if you're a man who are drifting. He's like this, as you say, a really, really attractive figure, very aspirational in that sense. So again, much though I really dislike much of his content, I think it's incumbent to understand his appeal and not to dismiss everyone who's attracted to him as just straightforwardly misogynist, but instead try and say, what is it here? What's missing here? Because there's something missing in our society that is allowing people like Andrew Tate to get 12 billion views. And so to that extent, I think Andrew Tate is our fault.
Yeah,
I don't blame Tate. I blame us.
I think in many ways, and I have heard him say this, Andrew Tate say this in interviews, that akin to the, you know, Trump to W analogy, which I thought was pretty brilliant and spot on, I think he knows what he's doing. Like Trump, he is more of a troll than anything else.
Yes.
And he's more of a genius at being able to circulate attention around him than anything else. And that as long as the attention gets on him, then he's achieved what his goal is, just like Trump did. And
that was his real. Yeah. Someone just told me, and I haven't fact checked this yet, but we could probably fact check in real time if I could do two things at once, but that his father was a professional chess player.
I think that's right. Yeah.
I don't know if he was a grandmaster or whatever, but like, and so, okay, like this is not, like, this is not a guy that just kind of, he didn't come from the fields, you know, I don't wish that to sound disparaging, but like, it's important that people don't dismiss him. Like, this is a guy from a very professional, potentially intelligent background. And I agree with you. I think he knows exactly what he's doing. And I think he's unlike Peterson, who I think gets in trouble for saying what he really thinks.
Yeah.
Even when it's wrong and or batshit crazy.
Yeah.
I think that Tate gets into trouble for saying stuff that he doesn't really believe. He just knows that in this world of very short form, clickable content, he's just mastered the algorithm of the short form video content.
Yes,
and he incentivized the people through his university to do it, but he's just absolute master of that. To really do it in that big way, I think, just to say, oh, okay, you know, just to make the people who are still doing podcasts, no offense, seem incredibly obsolete and boring and old fashioned, you know.
Yeah.
So
one other comment I just have to say before we move on to other aspects of the book that I want to talk about, it related to the Peterson and Tate comparison, is, you know, when I have always been fascinated by one aspect of Peterson's personality. And I should back up a little bit and say that, you know, Gabor Mate, who I hope to have on the show at some point, and I think is a really perceptive, you know, writer and thinker who's also Canadian, also a doctor, his analysis of Peterson that he thinks is not often talked about is the amount of simmering rage that you feel in him when he talks. And I had never quite had the words to put my finger on something specifically, but as soon as I heard that word, that rage word, it did click with me that is something that I think I had always felt in watching so many of Peterson's interviews. And Tate has that as well. I think one of the major differences between the two is that Peterson openly weeps very often. So you can oscillate between this extremely confident, competent, fast-talking, brilliant mind and someone who reads a comment from one of his YouTube followers and is crying openly. I also thought that was part of Peterson's massive appeal, and I think you kind of just alluded to this earlier, is the fact that he had an empathy periodically about him towards people who were suffering, especially boys, that I think indicated that he actually cared in a way that a lot of men, frankly, just don't feel cared for.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I've been struck by his genuine empathy.
Yeah,
for many of the people he's talking about, you don't fake that, which Tate has none of that. Tate's just, it's all your fault, basically. And I think that's obviously speaks to Peterson's own training, his own sensitivity. I mean, he's obviously got many of his own problems, in terms of mental health and so on, that he's been quite open about. But again, I think that's exactly right. I think he's unusual, actually, as a man, for being so open about his emotions and weeping so openly. I think it speaks to his sort of sensitivity too. And so again, I think that's very, very attractive to people. You can't watch him and not get a sense of that. I remember listening to a talk he gave, and the last question of the evening was from a guy that said, I was going to kill myself last week, but I decided not to, and to come to this lecture instead in case I heard something that would make me think differently about it. And the way Peterson dealt with that question was absolutely magnificent.
Yeah.
I mean, he was straight talking. He said, well, it's a good question, right? Why do we live? Why do we continue, right? And then he talked him through it in a way that I just thought was extraordinary. I mean, imagine you're on a stage, you get that question from this man, and his constructive, straightforward empathy for that young man was just visible on display to everybody in that room. Yeah. And I agree that that's a big part of his magic, and that a lot of young men generally, but especially young men, just don't feel that.
Yeah.
In a lot of their engagements and from society more broadly. And so he does feel like this incredibly refreshing break in that sense of a lack of empathy that a lot of young men feel. And again, he's not doing anything magic, right? He's just showing empathy. And that's why I think of him as this kind of listening ear. I think actually what Peterson says is actually much, much less important then how he listens, how he empathizes, how he signals he's on your side. He's much more ear than mouth. Mm. And I think people make the mistake of just focusing on what he says, like the stuff he says on climate change is just batshit crazy. But instead you'll get these headlines. He went on Rogan, I think. And you know, my wife and I were listening to it on the way up. And so it's quite good. And so he thinks out loud, right? And so you're always going to get this proportion. And there was this 10-minute thing about climate change. And my wife happens to know a lot about this more than I do. And we're both looking at each other going, this is insane.
Yeah.
And ignored it, right? No one should go. So public announcement. No one should go to Jordan Peterson for advice on climate change policy, right? But he had some other stuff that was good. But of course, all the headlines the next day were from all these climate change scientists saying, you know, Peterson dangerously wrong on climate change, says climate change scientist. And you're like, yeah, duh. I think we knew that, right?
Yeah. I was just talking to a friend about this last night that, you know, I think she and I have both been following his career for, he's been in the public eye for 8 years or so now. And his early videos really were about his sweet spot, which was his knowledge of psychology and the, you know, human nature and history and the Bible. And he's a fascinating mind who knows so much information. And I think to your point, when he sticks to what he has spent his entire career becoming an expert in, that's possibly really where he should be focusing most of his time. But he's human like we all are. We all have opinions, and we're more likely to be wrong about our opinions if we begin to talk to something that we don't know that much about.
Yes. And unlike most of us, he just keeps going. He just throws it out there. I mean, he specifically says when he comes on stage, I'm just going to talk about this problem. And he throws stuff out there, and he doesn't edit himself particularly. Yeah. And so that does mean, there's a lot of rubbish in there. But there's some good stuff too. His stuff on, I mean, he's become quite a good theologian. His series on Genesis.
Yeah.
It's just incredibly good.
Yeah. I want to talk about, and this is a subject I've wanted to talk about on this show as well, about men in divorce. And I'm old enough now where I have multiple friends who, have been in 10-year plus marriages, some have children, and for a variety of reasons, the marriage comes to an end. And I know you note this in your writing that it is often, and I don't think this is particularly well known either, that post-divorce, it is often men who really suffer the most. Mm-hmm. And my understanding as to why that is because women tend to take, on average, again, they tend to take the role of the social organizer, the social networker, the connector for their family and their community. And when that gets severed, these men, you talked about men opting out and isolating, it just becomes much, much more likely for men in that situation to begin to drift and to begin to, have some pretty serious mental health issues. I certainly have friends that, I had one friend who I knew from work who got divorced, had two young daughters, learned a few years after the divorce, he was suspicious that his wife was having an affair. She denied it. And then a few years after the divorce, she conceded that she had done this, and it was with one of his best friends. And he came to me and was, speaking like someone who was despairing. And I think that story is not one that is particularly welcome to be discussed in our, general culture, men who are suffering in divorce. But I'd love to give you a little bit of time to talk about your knowledge of what tends to happen to men when they, who have a family and then that family for a variety of reasons severs. One other just quick fact that I believe is true, and I'd love to get your confirmation on if this is correct, is that something like 70 to 80% of divorces in America are initiated by women. Anyways, I just wanted to put that to you and give you an opportunity to speak about that subject.
Yeah. So it's about 2/3.
Okay.
So about 2 to 1. That's across the whole spectrum of initiated by women. Women are also now less likely than men to say that being married is important to them. Mm. So there's a gap. I don't have the exact numbers off the top of my head, but there's at least a 10 percentage point gap. Men saying marriage is more important to them. And you're quite right that post-divorce, certainly on many measures of well-being, mental health, et cetera, it does seem to be much more negative for men than for women. And I also think it is the reasons, largely for the reasons you've identified, which is this sense of women very often doing more of the emotional labor, particularly within a relationship, maybe just being better at emotional labor generally. Mm. And so to some extent, men's emotional lives is propped up by the marriage. And so once the marriage goes, the props get cut away. Mm. And there's this post-divorce thing, which is like, who gets the friends? And that's when you find out, actually, that, oh my God, they're actually her friends. Because it's difficult to remain friends with both. And so I think it's a bit about that, that men suddenly discover that they've invested too much of their kind of emotional life in the marriage and the family. I also think that the sense that men have of their identity being bound into being a husband is today greater than the other way around. I think that being a wife is certainly something that many women choose, but actually it's kind of a much more disposable identity in today's world. Whereas being a husband does give a men sense of, okay, who are you? Like what do you do? Mm-hmm. And so if you lose that aspect of your identity as well, I think it has bigger effects on men than on women. So, you know, wifeless men really do struggle in modern societies. But again, it might be partly because of this lag, because we just haven't learned how to do these things differently in this new world. And I'm pretty hopeful that we will learn to do better. There's a big focus now, and there's been a big drop in friendship, and especially among men's friendships. And so that's actually something we've really got to start addressing. And so I'm hopeful that we will start course correcting and that men will start to realize that. It's certainly something in my own life. Like I've really talked to my own sons about this. Mm. And actually I've been incredibly happy when they've got really good friends. Mm. And candidly, even more so when they have really good male friends, you know, when they have just like really strong, solid friends they can go away with and travel with and do stuff with, because actually, you know, I know how important that's going to be for them going forward. The key is to maintain them, even as you enter into marriage and kids. I think there's been a slight sense for men. It's like, well, that was that period. Now I'm into this period.
Yeah.
Maybe also a bit of reluctance in this new world for men to continue to engage in those male friendships, even post-marriage. Mm. And everyone's under time pressure. So we'll see. And I think it's also true that women are just better at taking that physical time to invest in the friendships. Women, everything else equal, seem to be just a bit better at friendships than men. And we need to start catching up, because marriage is not going to be the substitute anymore.
Yeah. One of my favorite interviews that you've done about this book was with Chris Williamson, which I was listening to last night and this morning. And one of my favorite parts of that conversation was towards the end, which was really a conversation. And this is one of my extreme interests. I had David Buss on the show. He was one of the first few guests. I had Joe Henrich on the show a couple months ago. Is viewing life as much as possible in an attempt to understand what is going on through an evolutionary lens. And you and Chris seem to get into the subject of really the role of men historically and what the point of our existence really was from nature. And I'd love to spend a little bit of time just delving into that. And I thought you guys had an incredibly interesting back and forth about whether men really were there as, I think he or you phrased it as, basically an armed gun, or if we were there to extract the necessary calories that was required to feed a human baby through its, you know, childhood and adolescence. As best you understand it, what are the primary theories as to why men are here in the first place? How do you make sense of that question generally?
Yeah, so I think the problem of men is sort of always been with us. And as Joe Henrich puts it, the math problem of surplus men has been particularly a problem. Mm-hmm. And it was Roy Baumeister's work that drew me to the fact that we have twice as many female ancestors as male ancestors, because throughout history, men have only had about a 50% chance of reproducing, which explains from an evolutionary perspective all kinds of stuff like risk taking. Right? It makes much more sense to be have more of a tolerance for risk in an environment where, you know, 50% of you only have, you only have a 50% chance rather of reproducing. So, but it was then Chris was in, he'd had Roy Baumeister on, saying that it was much more this, just the whole point of the hunting and stuff was just to show that you were the better bodyguard. Yeah. The arm gun. And I was citing Anna Machen's work, in her book on fatherhood, which in turn referenced Sarah Hurdy's work on the kind of calorific requirements of the newly developed human brain and how that couldn't be done by one. So it just took more, you needed more calories. So you needed men to generate a surplus. How that surplus was divided up, whether it was by the tribe or the family, is a second order question. But you did need men to generate more calories, let's use that currency for now, than they needed for their own consumption. So that was new to me. And so what was actually happening was that we were basically just, he was arguing Roy Baumeister's case and I was arguing Anna Machen's case. And both Roy and Anna know a million times more about this than either Chris or I. So the thing you need to do is get them on, honestly, because I am basing it on a, I think, a pretty reasonably established sense that fatherhood in this kind of more modern sense, by which I mean a few thousand years old, really was about this, the need for men to be providing more, generating a surplus. And so the invention of the institution of fatherhood was kind of just about how much longer it took and how many more calories it took to get our kids into, you know, semi-independent creatures. So that may well not be true, but it seems to be pretty established in the literature that I know, and consistent with the evolutionary psych around what it means to be a father and how father's kind of attached to the kids, their testosterone goes down, as Joe Henrich and others point out. Mm-hmm. And so it does seem to me that we are kind of wired in certain ways to be fathers, and fathers in that kind of particularly in an attached way rather than a bodyguard way. And mm-hmm. so I think the weight of evidence has still got to be in that direction. But as I say, I haven't encountered this new idea of Baumeister, so I need to catch up.
Yeah. I know some of the data that you talk about in the book is, and I think this is particularly pernicious in some of the lower socioeconomic communities, minority communities in the country about, and the data on this is truly crazy. At least it was crazy to me when I started to learn about it, about, you know, the number of African American children who are being raised in homes without fathers, and it's well over 50%. And that's a massive shift from, I think it was the early 1960s, in which it was in the low 80s of children being raised with fathers in the home, and how much that has changed since then. And it's dipped a little bit, as I understand it, in families with parents with a college education, down something from roughly low 90s to low 80s percentages, something like that, but not nearly as drastic as what's happened in some of the poor and more minority communities. What do we know about what happens to kids who are raised without parents in the household, without fathers in the household, I should say?
Yeah. So the first thing is that your basic description of the trends is right. What I would add to that is that all of the big recent changes have been much more on class dimensions than race dimensions. And so the Black family has always looked pretty different in many ways to white families. And that's for reasons that are probably pretty obvious around the different economic conditions that Black families faced. And so, for example, like black women are more likely to be the main breadwinner in the family than Black men. Black women are much more educated than Black men. And these are not new findings. So in a sense, what's happening in a lot of white families now is something that's been happening for much longer in Black families. Mm-hmm. And so I would emphasize the class dimension of this now, which is, of course, overlapping with race hugely, and the educational divide on marriage is overlapping with race. But it does seem like if you look at the recent trends, actually the kind of trends have leveled out mostly for Black families, but they're really massively opening up by class, which I think you indicated. And so I do think that means that for that life in those sorts of families is very different. And in particular, what it means is that we have to move, I think, and here is where social conservatives strongly disagree with me, move away from the idea of marriage is the glue between men and children, indirectly, usually through the mom. Right. So if you think of the old fashioned marriage as direct relationship between mom and kids, direct relationship between dad and mom, and a dotted line from dad to kid. Right? He didn't have that strong a direct relationship with the kids because his job was to bring home the bacon. That model has to shift to one where there's a more direct relationship between fathers and children, because it's not clear what the relationship between the father and the mother is going to be. And I don't think we can bet on marriage. We certainly can't bet on old fashioned marriage as a condition of economic dependency of the woman on the man, and that sharp division of labor, that's gone, that's in the rearview mirror. And in this sense, actually, Black Fathers are quite interesting, because what they're showing is that the simplistic idea of a father being either absent or present, living with or without, away from his children, doesn't capture the complexity of the situation. Mm. Actually, what matters is the relationship between the parents and the children, and whether that can transcend physical location. So fatherhood isn't like taking attendance at a class, mm. present or absent. This whole idea of an absent father really has to be unpacked, because it turns out that, and Black fathers are more likely to be engaged with their kids if they're not living with the mum than fathers of other races. Mm. And that's probably partly because it is more common among Black families. And so it's the relationship that counts. And in fact, there was one study I found which showed that fathers who were not living with the mother but had a very strong relationship with their kids did better than fathers and the kids of fathers who were living with the mother but had a very distant relationship with their kids, right? So better to have a divorced dad that you're very close to than a dad who just comes home and goes straight to his study or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And so what's lost in the debate about structure is relationships are what count. And I feel very strongly that we have to get to a model of fatherhood that's based on that direct relationship between fathers and kids. And I have a whole bunch of policies to try and support that. But the cultural point here is this: we have just gone through a massive cultural transformation of the very basis of the family.
Yeah.
Like, to the extent that there was this glue, which was women raise kids economically dependent on men to bring home the bacon, the women's movement went straight at that. Absolutely, clearly, explicitly said, we have to go at that situation. And we do know we're in a situation now where 40% of women earn more than the typical man, mm. up from 13% in 1979. Mm. 40% of breadwinners are now women. Like, this is a whole new world. Mm. This is not a trivial change. This is, we have utterly transformed the economic relationships between men and women, as the women's movement hoped, and as most of us celebrate. But let's not be naive about this. That has huge downstream consequences for the roles of men and women. And right now, we haven't paid much attention. Well, this conversation is a good example of us paying attention to it. But yeah. What does that mean for the role of men? And what the conservatives were right about in the 70s is, if the women's movement is successful, we're going to have a big question about what to do with the men. They were absolutely right about that. They were wrong about the answer, which was, let's not do it then. Mm. Let's keep women in the kitchen. Otherwise, the men will be marauding. That was the wrong answer for all kinds of moral and other reasons, but they were right to be concerned.
Yeah, that is absolutely fascinating, because I will tell you, I mean, so I'm in my mid-30s, and I get the sense that so many of my, you know, male friends in the privacy of, you know, friendship-driven conversation are rather reluctant to engage in having their own kids because of a fear of divorce and the stigma of divorce, but may actually be interested in having children of their own. And I think, if I'm understanding you correctly, the major point is, it isn't maintaining the marriage itself that seems to have the long-term benefits for the children. It's the strength of the relationship, the enduring strength of the relationship of the father with the children, almost regardless of whether they stay married or not.
That's my reading of the evidence. Yeah. Now, to be fair, a good social conservative critic would say, yes, but that's much easier if you're married.
Yeah.
And that's true. So yeah. I just think it's crazy to deny that's true. That, like, if you want strong relationships between both parents and the kids, it's undeniably easier if you're doing that under the same roof. Mm-hmm. And in the context of a marriage or equivalently committed relationship, no question. So is it harder? Yes. But in the end, so you have to work harder to maintain those relationships, for sure. But it's really just that maintaining that quality of relationship does seem to be the thing that's key. And you are seeing that now. So after divorce now, men are getting a third of the time with kids. There are almost no sole custody arrangements. Mm-hmm. And actually, there's pretty good evidence now that after divorce, there are strong relationships maintaining between both kids. Now, I will say that's partly because the people selecting into marriage now, I think, are doing so with a strong commitment to the kids, mm. and that commitment survives the dissolution of the marriage. So divorced dads of today are not like the divorced dads of 40 years ago, right? They got married in order to have kids,
yeah.
putting it too simplistically. And so if the marriage ends, they still see their role as fathers quite seriously. So there's a selection effect for sure, which is not much less true of men who are not married. So when people say, okay, divorced dads are in their kids' lives much more than, say, previously cohabiting dads, that's true, but I think that's because of a selection effect. Like, the dads who are cohabiting largely weren't planning to have the kid in the first place with that woman. Yeah. They make a go of it, but it doesn't work out. And so it seems to me that there's the intentionality of becoming a father, and sure, ideally with the mum, make it work. But that role, the role of father, doesn't dissolve along with the marriage. And it's incredibly important that we move beyond seeing marriage as the foundation for the relationship between fathers and children.
Yeah, I think that's a terrific point. I know we are getting a little bit close to the end of the conversation, and before we close with maybe one more subject, I just want to thank you for all the work that you have put into this, because I think this is an extremely important taboo subject that is probably uniquely possible to be written from somebody like yourself. And, I think if we are going to have a sane conversation, it has to be based in reality as best we understand it. And I just appreciate the fact that you have given so much of, your talents and energy to putting this together and spending so much time on, giving voice to, a lot of the truths of society, but also to a lot of men who I think really are suffering and feel rather invisible. And I'd love to close with, just putting this to you of, where do we go from here? And I know one of your primary policy suggestions is that potentially we should be starting boys a year after girls in, kindergarten or first grade, so they have a little bit more time to develop, to catch up with women based on the neuroscience that we now understand about the development of the female and male brain. Any other closing thoughts as to, where we can go from here in terms of, because this is really about, you said this word earlier, it's about flourishing. It's about having both genders living as best they can. Anything else come to mind how else you might think about that for men and boys specifically?
Well, first of all, thank you again for your kind words. And I'll say one note on that is that I do think it's important for people like me to be engaging in this debate, with the sort of policy wonkery and facts and solutions that you'd expect from a Brookings Institution scholar, because it sort of mainstreams it somewhat. And Matthew Iglesias had a long review of the book over on his Substack, Slow Boring, which is excellent. Mm-hmm. And he said that the book was earnest, bordering on banal, and it was the highest praise imaginable. I just sort of encourage your listeners to say the book. I'm quite proud of how well written the book is, but the point, the polemic, the rhetorical point that, like, yes, I want it to be earnest, almost banal. Like, this is good. Like, this is, these are problems. Let's just address them like sensible people, right? And I'm a sensible person working at a sensible institution, making what I think are sensible suggestions, which we can agree or disagree with. But I think that making this as a conversation among sensible people of goodwill is just hugely important, and I'm proud to have played even a small part in helping to bring that about. Then I get into some solutions, and I'm glad you raised it, because and I encourage people to go and have a look at it. Actually, I deliberately spent a lot of time on solutions, risking policy wonkery, risking how much are people willing to read about technical high schools, right? And I estimated about a page. But yes, I think we should think about starting schools, boys in school a year later, because they're developmental disadvantages. We need a massive recruitment drive of male teachers. We do need much bigger investment in vocational training, including technical high schools and apprenticeships, which disproportionately help boys and men. Mm. I would throw a lot of political capital and financial capital at getting more men into the growing sectors of the economy, and like health and education, and by the way, psychology. Which is becoming progressively, among psychologists under 30, only 5% are male.
Wow.
The profession as a whole is 29% male. So you talked about, who was it you referred to earlier? The 80-year-old psychologist?
James Hollis.
Yeah, Hollis, who I now look up. But it's like, okay, I'm not surprised he's got all these men, because, where else are they going to go? So get more men into those professions for sure. And then shoring up this new direct model of fatherhood through generous paid leave provision that is attached to fathers and not transferable, equally generous for mothers, as well as a much fairer treatment of unmarried men who really get a very, very, they get the sharp end of the stick from the child support system and the access system. And so just revalorizing the importance of fatherhood through public policy. So I'm putting all those ideas out there because I do want this to be a solutions focused conversation as well. There's been a lot of discussion of these subjects, but sometimes they're like the secular equivalent of the Book of Lamentations. And so, okay, like here's a million problems. And then at the end, you've got, I don't know, universal pre-K or something. And so I really did go hard into solutions. And I'm getting lots of disagreement and agreement with those ideas. But at least we're talking about solutions.
Mm.
And it seems to me that that's an important part of the debate. And one of the things I really wanted to push us to. So I'm thrilled when people say, no, no, I don't like that idea for helping boys in school. Here's another idea.
Yeah.
I'm like, great. I'm here for that. Because by the way, we just agree there's a problem we need to solve. And that's for me, if we can get to the point where we're saying, yeah, there's obviously a problem here. Let's argue about the solutions. Great. That gets us away from the culture war. It gets us away from lamentation. And it gets us into the maybe less sexy stuff. I don't think I'm going to get 12 billion TikTok views from even the best clip of this conversation, Dan, but let's aim high. Certainly not with my discussion of technical high schools or your obsession with evolutionary psychology. But this is where the real conversation has to happen.
Yeah. I get the sense that this book will be not only a consciousness raising piece of art, but also will be, I just think, will be one of the more important books of this time period. And it's a real pleasure to be able to do this, Richard. And I can't wait to share this. And we'll aim high with the TikTok video views for sure.
Yeah. But Andrew Tate level.
Andrew Tate level. But more than anything, man, thank you again for all the hard work and for doing this. This is a real honor for me to be able to do. And best of luck with everything.
Well, back at you. Thanks for having me on. And thank you for such a thoughtful conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you for listening to this episode of Keep Talking. If you're finding value in this podcast, please consider supporting the show via the links below on Venmo, PayPal, or Patreon. Your support helps to make these conversations possible.